Honors, may it please the court. Srinivas Raju on behalf of the Casey Appellees. I would like to introduce to the court my co-counsel, Mr. Blair Connolly of the Latham & Watkins firm in New York. And also at Appellees Council table are John Reed and Mr. Timothy Hoffner of DLA Piper, who are representing the members of the Conflicts Committee.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you. Good morning.
Your Honor, Mr. Connolly has been admitted pro hoc vice and with the permission of the court, he'll be making the presentation on behalf of appellees.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jessica Zeldin on behalf of the appellants. I rise for the purpose of introducing my co-counsel, Mr. Ethan Wall. Mr. Wall will be making today's arguments on behalf of the appellants.
Welcome, Mr. Wall.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Chief Justice, members of the court, this case concerns the rights of public investors under a particular limited partnership agreement, but it also raises the basic question of how a Delaware court is supposed to go about interpreting one of these complex and at times muddy public entity limited partnership agreements. And what the court below did here is fundamentally at odds with the interpretive rules articulated by this court. This court has repeatedly held that where there's ambiguity in a partnership agreement, perhaps especially one involving public investors, you construe that ambiguity against the drafter. And what a Delaware court is not supposed to do is parse contractual language to find a new interpretation not presented by the parties that further narrows public investors' already limited contractual protections. So here the defendants recognize that the $18 million side payment to the general partner presented a conflict of interest, and it appropriately activated the conflicts committee as contemplated by the conflicts provisions of the limited partnership agreement, section 7.9. And the defendants never suggested in the proxy, in their opening brief, in their reply brief, at oral argument, that the conflicts process was merely an elective. And they had good reason to think that they were bound by Section 7.9. It establishes a detailed framework for protecting public unit holders from general partner self-dealing, and certainly does not say that these protections against general partner overreaching apply only if the general partner elects to have them do so.
Mr. Wall, just one clarification about the merits of your claim, and tell me if I had this right. The $18 million payment was for an interest, I guess it was a contingent interest of some sort, in the partnership. I don't understand your side to be arguing that that interest had zero value. My understanding, but correct me if I'm wrong, is that it didn't have $18 million of value, and that was for the court to review that valuation issue and decide what the proper allocation should be. Is that correct?
That is correct, Justice Jacobs. But just to confirm, the analysis is that it had almost zero value. That is somewhere between 1/100th and 1/200th of the $18 million valuation assigned to it in the deal. And just one other point of clarification, while Your Honor is exactly right that the proxy described the $18 million payment as being on account of the IDRs, it's certainly instructive that the defendants decided to recede from that in their arguments to this court, and instead they now say that the $18 million is fair, not because that's what the incentive distribution rights were worth, but now they say that should be viewed as a control premium. And by the way, if you apply that to the general partner interests that were held by the general partner here, you get a control premium, so-called, of something over 1,000%. So if the drafters had wanted to make the conflict section optional, they could have easily just said it was, the same way twice in that self-same section they said that special approval was an optional process. But they didn't. And so it's just not consistent with Delaware law to do what the motion court did here, parse the relevant contractual language to find grounds to conclude that the LPA doesn't provide the protection that a reasonable investor would have read it to provide and which the general partner itself thought it was bound to provide. So I stand ready at Your Honor's direction to parse out the relevant LPA provisions in greater detail, but I submit that the analysis of the conflicts provision under the LPA can really stop there. So the issue then becomes, was there valid special approval that takes the fair and reasonable determination that Justice Jacobs referred to a moment ago under Section 7.9 away from the court? And the answer is no, as shown by both process and result. First, as to process, the conflicts committee undisputedly never even looked at the side payment, and its financial advisor made no attempt to analyze it. That is, according to the proxy, the very payment that resulted in the conflicts committee being activated was not scrutinized by the conflicts committee in any way. And when a contract, as here, tasks a party with determining whether, to quote the LPA, a conflict of interest and any resolution of such conflict of interest is fair and reasonable, that party has simply not performed the contract when it fails to perform any analysis of the payment that represents the conflict.
So is your argument's with the analysis, because there was a conclusion, wasn't there, that the merger was fair and reasonable?
Justice Ridgely, there was a conclusion that the overall merger was fair and reasonable, not based on any analysis of the IDR, the ostensible IDR payment, the $18 million side payment.
Well, if the if there had been no $18 million side payment, would there be a claim that the and assuming that the unit holders got the same amount of dollars as they actually got, would there be a claim here? Would you be in court?
No.
All right. So this is really about some a figure that's somewhere between $100,000 and $18 million. Is that correct?
It is, Your Honor, but there's a separate injury to the class separate from simply the diversion of $18 million, and it's this. If a public investor puts money into a master limited partnership, he or she or it does so with knowledge that, as an investor, they have limited protections pursuant to the terms of the LPA. But what a rational investor would do is look at alignment of interest and understand that they had the protection of the general partner being interested first in growing the business as a fellow equity holder.
Well, that's a legal point. My question is, are you seeking any relief other than a dollar figure somewhere between $100,000 and $18 million?
So the answer, Your Honor, is yes, and it's not readily determinable, but here is the point, that we cannot know, sitting or standing here today, whether the general partner would have ever approved this deal had it received only the same consideration as the limiteds. And so what the limited partners, the members of the class, have lost here is a faithful general partner whose interests are in alignment with theirs. And again, I readily concede calculating the damages for that is hard, but it is, I would submit, a more profound injury than the loss of their proportionate share of $18 million to have lost the general partner's actions in alignment as they should have been with the interests of the limiteds here.
Why isn't it fair to assume that the general partner would not have approved the transaction without the $18 million side payment after looking at the way in which the negotiations played out?
Chief Justice, there was some suggestion actually in some of the defendants' papers, which admittedly are not evidence, that the $18 million was a condition to the general partner approving the deal, and that it was taking advantage of its control position to block the deal and was extracting the $18 million as a matter of right in a way to consent to this transaction.
So what's the answer to the question?
The answer to the question, forgive me, could I ask the Chief Justice to...
Sure. I look at the facts as they appear in the papers we have that suggest how the negotiations took place. My question was, cannot you assume from the way in which the negotiations took place that it was important to the general partner to have the $18 million side payment, or they never would have approved the ultimate transaction?
Yes, I think that's correct, Chief Justice. So looking at the process and the result here, first as to process, again, the Conflicts Committee never looked at the side payment, and given the explicit task that it was assigned under the terms of the limited partnership agreement, the failure to do so represents a breach. And the steps that the Conflicts Committee undertook here further support the view that it just fundamentally misapprehended its responsibility, because what the proxy says it did do was weigh in on issues vis-a-vis the counterparty, the acquirer, Kirby, where there would be no question that the general partner's interests were in alignment with the limited's. That is to say, the size of the breakup fee, the reverse breakup fee, the go shop right, all of that are items where the general partner's interest would naturally be perfectly in alignment with the limiteds. And for the Conflicts Committee to get involved in those issues and not focus on the fairness of the $18 million payment that again prompted its activation just suggests that the Conflicts Committee didn't understand what its role was here. And the defective process is also reflected in the outcome of the merger negotiations.
Before you move on to that, help me understand how you balance the ability to rely upon a fairness opinion from a qualified investment banker and at the same time make inquiry into why it's not reliable. How does this safe harbor provision, which I must say is this is not the only agreement we've seen or will see that has a similar provision. I'm trying to get a better understanding of the role of the special committees under these circumstances when it appears that the agreement says to all in the beginning, if they retain a competent investment banker who gives them a fairness opinion, that's a safe harbor upon which they can rely.
Well, 2 points, Chief Justice. One is that the conclusive presumption to which Your Honor refers is in Section 7.10, which is titled Other Matters Regarding the General Partner or something to that effect. And so its application to the special approval process conducted by a separate decision-making body, the Conflicts Committee, is far from clear, and I'd suggest that it simply doesn't have application in this situation. That is 710B specifically refers to what the general partner can do, and that's outside of the framework of Section 7.9, which is addressed to conflicts of interest. But there's a second point as well, and that is without trying to determine within the broader context of the LPA exactly when the conclusive presumption does or doesn't apply. What it certainly says is that the decision to be entitled to conclusive presumption, the decision made by the general partner, has to be made in reliance on that opinion. And it is certainly true that if we had a situation where there was an opinion as to fairness and the issue were fairness, that by its terms that language would apply. Here we have a determination, that is the payment of that $18 million, that simply was not addressed at all by the by the financial advisor here and was not addressed at all in the opinion that was referenced. In fact, the financial advisor explicitly disclaimed any view about the fairness of the allocation of the consideration here.
So your position is that the special committee then has to inquire into the efficacy or the completeness or the utility of the fairness opinion. They're just not entitled to be shielded by the existence of a fairness opinion. Is that correct?
If I could restate it slightly differently, Your Honor.
Sure.
They have to look at what the fairness opinion is actually addressed to. So if the fairness opinion says allocation is fair, that would be a different case than what we have here, where the financial advisor explicitly disclaimed any reference to the issue that's before the court today, which is whether it was fair for the general partner to get $18 million.
Well, I suppose that the other side would respond to your argument that you're looking at this issue of reliance a little too myopically. The fairness opinion did opine that the consideration that went to the unit holders was fair, totally apart from the $18 million. And the general partner, you know, having been given that comfort, could then bargain separately for $18 million or whatever value it was able to bargain for, without fear that would be unfair to the unit holders.
Well, Justice Jacobs, that would indeed be their argument, but what that misses is the fact that fairness, as opined to by any financial advisor, is a range of value. And to say that the ultimate amount that was payable to the public unit holders was fair, meaning within that range of value, is consistent with a massive amount of value diversion to the general partner. So if a number appeared anywhere in this range of fair value, that doesn't validate the separate payment of sums to the general partner that were completely unjustified on an economic basis by the interest on account of which they were ostensibly paid.
And my response or my question is, why doesn't it justify it? Under this partnership agreement, the general partner could have vetoed the entire deal, which means that the unit holders would get nothing. The unit holders, he didn't veto it, or the GP didn't veto it. The unit holders got an amount of money that the investment banker opined was fair, that your side isn't challenging, at least on the merits. That being the case, where is the violation, you know, in terms of the partnership agreement of the general partner bargaining to get whatever it could?
I would submit, Your Honor, that to pay a disproportionate amount of a limited fund, that is the total amount that Kirby was willing to pay for the limited partnership, to divert some portion of that to the general partner beyond what its ownership interest would warrant, simply because it has control and can attempt to extract disproportionate value, is not fair and reasonable. But ultimately...
But wait a second. The fairness opinion says that the compensation to the unit holders is fair, right? And you're saying, well, that's not good enough because the fairness opinion didn't take into account the impact of the side payment to the general partner. But isn't it true that if the payment to the side payment were of significant value, it would, by definition, have to reduce the amount that the unit holders were getting as part of the deal? And at some point, a financial advisor would say, no, this deal is not fair. Whether it's because of that or not, this is less than what they should get. So why doesn't the fairness opinion cover the problem?
Justice Berger, at some point, it is correct to say that sufficient value diversion would take the consideration below the low end of a range that a financial advisor would be willing to opine was fair. But that range is broad, and the proposition that it is fair and reasonable for the general partner of a limited partnership to extract value beyond what its economic interests justify, I submit, is simply not correct. That fair and reasonable implies something close to what we would deem entire fairness in a different context. And a transaction and the allocation of consideration in a transaction is simply not fair and reasonable if the general partner bargains to get more than its interest warrants.
Mr. Wall, you're into your rebuttal time, but let me give you a chance to think about answering the question that comes to my mind. There are two phrases in the agreement. One is good faith, which is not a defined term, if I remember correctly, and the other is the best interest of the partnership. When you get a chance, would you address that in terms of the duty either of the special committee or of the general partner?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors. This case is governed by a contract.
Mr. Connolly, Chief Justice just anticipated the question that I was going to ask, so why don't we at least get your side of it. There are three concepts that seem to be floating around in this agreement. One is good faith. The provision that creates an exclusive presumption as certain procedures are followed. Secondly, there's the fair and reasonable standard. And thirdly, the best interests of the partnership. What is the interaction of those three concepts under this agreement?
I think perhaps best to analyze that in terms of the transaction. I think that there is a protective provision.
You're not able to do it in the abstract?
I'll try. I'll do my best. The good faith concept is there is a protective measure, and it says that the directors and affiliates, as they're defined, cannot be liable unless they acted in bad faith other than in the best interest of the partnership. There's also the provision in 7.10D that says that any standards are modified to allow the general partner to act as long as it didn't act in a way that it did not reasonably believe to be the best interest of the partnership. I think that, and there's also 7.8C, which I think is important, which states that any duties that might otherwise exist at law are expressly, including fiduciary duties,
okay,
are replaced.
Let's assume counterfactually,
yes,
that good faith provision, you know, no liability, you know, if the general partner and affiliates acted in good faith, and conclusively presumed if special approval procedures are followed. Suppose that were not in the agreement at all, then what standard under this contract would apply?
I think the standard would, in this particular transaction, because it's a third-party merger transaction, would be the sole discretion standard in Article 14, subject only to the one thing that you cannot do away with under a limited partnership agreement under Delaware law, which is the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Okay, so there would be at least arguably a good faith and fair dealing claim.
You cannot get rid of that under the statute. There's no claim of an implied covenant breach in this case.
But you do get rid of it under the good faith provision because there's no liability, even if, there's no liability because good faith is conclusively presumed if one follows the special approval.
It's an interesting question, and I think the way I reconcile it is that you have contractual good faith, which is a standard the contract sets. In this case, it's that the general partner did not reasonably believe that the transaction was in the best interest of the partnership. That's a subjective standard.
That's the way in which you define good faith under this contract.
That's what the vice chancellor found, and that's what I believe is correct. So
is there some rational explanation for why good faith is not a defined term, so we know what the parties intended, at least the drafter.
I can't explain why the drafters did it the way they did it. I think that the best you can do is to point to that provision as the best indicator of what they meant by good faith.
Well, when you struggle to give meaning to all the terms of a contract, and someone uses a term like good faith, which has been litigated ad nauseum with limited utility, at least in my view, in terms of application in the real world, such an amorphous concept, you would think someone would attempt to define the term as it's to be used in this contract. It's not helpful not to know what the drafter intended it to mean.
I understand. I think in this particular case, though, that because, as I said, because it's a third-party merger, I don't think you get there. I don't think you get to that issue.
Okay,
because
you could explain why, because just as Justice Jacobs articulated, we've got to bring all this together at the end of the
right.
day to determine whether whatever duties existed were fulfilled or not.
Sure.
And why?
Well, under Article 14, the contract sets out how the partnership is going to be governed and how it can be sold. Article 14 is the provision that deals with merger transactions, and it imposes two requirements. The general partner has to consent. The general partner is given discretion whether to consent. Section 7.9A says that when you have consent, when you have discretion, that is sole discretion, and you expressly do not have to consider the interests of anybody else. That's the standard under Article 14 for the general partner's consent. And if that happens, then it just goes to the unit holders to decide for themselves.
But the vote of the unit holders, in this case at least, included the majority control vote of the general partner and affiliates, correct?
That is not...
There's no separate class vote.
That's not true. But B, I think even if it were true, it wouldn't matter. But let me get to the most important point. It is not the case that the general partner held the majority of that vote. I think that under the contract, even if they did, it would be okay because
well,
the contract...
Let me ask it differently.
Sure.
The vote that took place in this case approving the merger, that is the unit holder vote, did that vote consist entirely of unaffiliated unit holders?
The vote did not consist entirely of unaffiliated unit holders.
What portion of the vote was represented by affiliated unit holders?
Affiliated unit, meaning affiliated with the general partner?
Yes.
Very low, 4%. The important thing to understand, and I'm trying to correct something that is in the other side's briefs here, 49% of the vote was held by KA First Reserve. They're the ones who came in a year earlier, made a huge cash infusion, and got preferred units and the definition of a unit majority under the contract, and it's a contract, and this is the way it's defined. The definition of a unit majority is all the common units, including the preferred units on an as-converted basis. So KA First Reserve had 49.9% of the vote.
And okay? What relationship, if any, did they have with the general partner of the partnership?
They were just the investors who came in and made the cash infusion. But the key is they did not get one penny of this $18 million payment, not one penny. What they got was exactly and only what the common unit holders got. If you look at the S-4, it explains it, and I can find the page if you give me a moment. But the common unit holders had a choice. Okay, they had a choice between 815 in cash, I believe, was the price for their common units, or they could take a split, half that amount plus half in Kirby stock.
Does the record accurately show that the unit holders, common unit holders, that approved this transaction were overwhelmingly unaffiliated?
Yes.
Independent?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. It overwhelmingly shows that there was no taint on that vote that can be attributed to this $18 million payment that is the entire basis for their case. And I'm glad this came up because I wanted to correct that. It's important to understand, KA First Reserve, what they got, and it's right there in the S-4, the only difference between what they got and what the common unit holders got is that they didn't have a choice. They had to take the split. They had to take the $4 and whatever half of 15 cents is plus an equivalent amount at the same exact exchange rate in Kirby stock. Every single common unit holder had the ability to get exactly what they got. Arguably, K First Reserve got a worse deal because they did not have the option to take cash, and it's always better to have an option.
Okay, well, the reason I'm asking is that I think it's your side that relies as precedent on the Sonnet decision.
Yes, sir.
Back to 1998.
Yes.
The other side says, no, this isn't Sonnet, because in Sonnet there was an approval by you know, unaffiliated independent unit holders, and that wasn't the case here. You're saying it was the case here.
Well, I think two things in Sonnet.
Was the case here or not?
I believe if you just look at the math, there was clearly a majority of unaffiliated unit holders, clearly. But I do want to make two other points. In Sonnet, the contract required a supermajority. Here, the contract requires a simple unit majority. And there's also one other provision that I think...
Does that matter, though? The supermajority, they were not controlled by the affiliated, by affiliated people. Is that right?
I believe that's in Sonnet. That's correct. That's correct. But my point was that, you know, again, I get back to the statute and maximizing the principle of freedom of contract and the enforceability of the contracts. The provision says that if you have the general partner's consent in their sole discretion and you have approval of the unit majority as defined, and that is a majority of the outstanding, including the preferred on an as-converted basis, then under Article 14, once those two things happen, the certificate of merger shall be filed. Article 14 requires nothing more. It does not require a showing that the merger is fair and reasonable to the partnership, and that makes sense, because whether it's fair and unreasonable or not, the unit holders have an absolute unfettered right to vote it down. It's in their hands.
So this is a Sonnet, just a different variation of Sonnet.
I believe that's right, but I did want to respond to your factual
point. I believe.
I'm sorry. You are correct.
All right.
Yeah, and I wanted to respond to your factual point as well, that there is also, as in Sonnet, no concern that the people getting this $18 million payment had the vote in their pocket. If anybody, the people with the single biggest economic stake here, KA First Reserve, who had almost 50% of the vote, were not getting anything different than what the common did, and they liked the deal. They liked it, and they voted for it, and they signed a contract to vote for it, and that ought to give any court great comfort about it.
Is it your position that if the investment banker's opinion said that the consideration going solely to the unit holders is not fair and it's not reasonable, then it wouldn't make any difference?
It is my position that they didn't have to go through that process. They did not have to go through special approval. They could have just gone straight on Article 14, which is what happened in Sonnet.
Let me say it differently.
Yes.
If this was not fair, reasonable consideration going to the unit holders, but they voted for it anyway, as occurred here, then there would be no judicial review. Is that correct?
If the unit holders wanted the deal, I think it's their contractual right to take it.
Fair or not?
Fair or not. They have the unmitigated right to vote it up or vote it down, and they did so. And I do want to make one other point about the unit holder vote. There is also Section 16.10 of the LPA, which says that, I can't quote it exactly, but what it says is that any time under the LPA, there is a decision that can be made based on a vote of less than all of the unit holders. All unit holders agree to be bound by that decision. So, in other words, they expressly agreed that they would not have a majority of the minority vote under this agreement. They bargained that away.
But in fact, they did. There was a majority of the minority vote, if I understand your position.
Factually, there was. It's quite overwhelming.
This might be off the subject, but assuming the fairness opinion came back, no, this is not fair. You just finished answering a question and saying the vote is the vote and it wouldn't matter. But wouldn't there be a viable argument that if the transaction was deemed unfair by an independent advisor, that the general partner would be found to not have been acting in good faith to approve it?
I don't think so, because the contract specifically says that in exercising its discretion, it is sole discretion, and it's not required, expressly not required, to consider the interests of anyone else, including the partnership or the limited partners. And so, given that express contractual right, I don't think you could say that it would be bad faith.
So the general partner doesn't have to act in good faith?
I think that...
Under that provision?
I want to be very careful how I answer that. There is no requirement under the contract that that discretion be exercised in good faith. To the contrary, Section 7.9 says that when this contract gives someone sole discretion, they shall be subject to that standard and no other. And no other means including good faith. There's no requirement in Article 14 that that discretion be exercised in good faith. As I said, and as the statute provides, there is always the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing as a backstop.
Yeah, and how does that relate to the amorphous, undefined term good faith in this contract?
You could interpret it as meaning nothing more than incorporating that doctrine. I think that in this context, and as I said, there is no claim of violation of the implied covenant here, but in this particular context, when the contract gives the general partner an express right of sole discretion, I don't think there's a gap to be filled. I don't think that you can take away that express right based on an implied covenant argument under this court's case law.
Well, you can take it away, can't you, if that discretion is exercised in bad faith? Either under the concept of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, or this freestanding two-word good faith duty that I'm struggling to figure out how it plays out in this agreement.
I don't think you get to the contractual good faith unless you've first shown that there's a breach, and then you ask a question, well, did they breach it in good faith or in bad faith, because that's a requirement for imposing liability. But under the implied covenant standard, I don't think you can argue that they exercise that discretion in bad faith and that's a breach unless you show that they exercised it in an arbitrary and unreasonable way that doesn't serve any interest of theirs and that deprives the other side of the fruits of the contract. The fruits of the contract here was, if the general partner decides in its sole discretion to go forward with the deal, you get to vote on it. And if you lose, you lose. If the majority of your fellows disagree with you, you agreed in advance to be bound by that decision. Those were the fruits.
So your answer, if I understand it correctly, to the Chief Justice's question is, you know, since there was at least de facto, a majority of the minority approval by the unit holders, you never get to the issue of good faith.
I that's right.
Well,
that's right.
In other words, even if everybody was acting in bad faith, as long as there was an informed approving vote, that disposes of the case. Is that right?
That's right. There's nothing in Article 14. Now, you always have the implied covenant if it somehow came into play. There's no claim of that here.
Let me follow up then. Let's assume, again, I understand that didn't happen here, but let's assume that the vote that occurred was controlled. That is, that a majority of the votes that were cast were affiliated by affiliated persons, so that it wasn't the majority of the minority of, the vote. What then, what role then would good faith play?
I don't think there's anything under the statute of the contract that prohibits, if we were to assume that the general partner, for example, owned 90% of the vote, and they exercised it, and they went forward with it. I don't think there's anything out of the statute or the contract that would cause a problem with that. Now, you could probably hypothesize a situation in which it would violate the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing that is always present.
There would at least be a litigatable claim under the implied covenant if there was a controlled vote.
If there was, I don't think that a controlled vote alone would give rise to a claim for breach of the implied covenant. But if there were other facts that would allow a claim under the existing case law, I'm not saying there's no possibility of it. There's always the implied covenant. I just don't. There's no claim here, and I don't think it comes into play here, given the way the contract is written. So I was. The first point I wanted to talk about was Article 14, which, as the Vice Chancellor found, just has these two requirements, both of which were made. And their argument, the other side's argument, is to get around that, is to say that the 7.9a conflicts provision is mandatory rather than a safe harbor. We think that's wrong for several reasons, one of which is The drafters clearly knew how to make something mandatory when they wanted it to be. If you look at 7.6D, it's the provision dealing with affiliate transactions, sales to or from the general partner. That provision expressly says that the transaction has to be fair and reasonable to the partnership. They did not put that language in 7.9A. The drafters knew how to do it. They chose not to in 7.9A. 7.9A, while they rely very heavily on the word whenever that's in 7.9A, they don't pay attention to what follows. Because what it doesn't say is whenever there's a possibility of a conflict of interest, the transaction shall be deemed fair and reasonable or must be deemed fair and reasonable. It just says that whenever there's a conflict of interest, if one of these conditions is met, then it will be deemed approved by all partners. And that's exactly how you draft a safe harbor, which is what we submit the Vice Chancellor properly found this was. Their interpretation would actually render Section 7.D superfluous. If they're correct, and 7.9A requires that every single conflict transaction always has to be fair and reasonable to the partnership, there's no reason to have 7.6D, which says a particular subset of conflict of transactions have to be fair and reasonable. You can also contrast it with Section 7.9B, which actually does use the word shall and does expressly sweep aside other contractual standards. It says that when, as here, the contract provides for sole discretion, the general partner shall be subject to that standard and no other, and shall not be required to take into account anybody else's interests.
Well, that reads on the decision by the general partner to negotiate separately for the $18 million, correct?
You know, I don't know that there's anything in the contract that touches on that decision at all, because those IDRs and its general partner units are the general partner's property. And I've never frankly understood how the common unit holders have anything to say about
that. The claim here is that while the general partner may have been entitled contractually to negotiate for the fair value of its property, it wasn't permitted to divert to itself what otherwise would have been payable or paid to the unit holders. That's the claim.
Understood. And my friend spent a lot of time talking about what, in an abstract sense, the contract should be read to mean, but we didn't hear a lot about what it says. And what
well,
it says...
Does the sole discretion provision read on that claim?
I believe that they have just as much sole discretion. They have sole discretion whether to consent to a merger, and they do not have to consider anybody else's interests. I think that, properly read, that does mean they are allowed to consider any other interests, such as, for example, whether I feel like I'm being paid enough for my control, whether I feel like I'm being paid enough for my cash distribution rights that would otherwise continue in this entity that is now going to be owned by another strategic buyer. And who may very well want to get rid of me for that reason, because they presumably don't want to share the economic upside of this entity that they intend to control and run. So I think the answer to your question, yes, although I maybe could have answered it more quickly. But I did want to point to a couple of provisions, because the argument that we heard this morning is that in some general sense, either the general partner or the conflicts committee was supposed to weigh this difference between what the common unit holders were getting and what the general partner was getting. I don't know how they do that, but that they were supposed to do that. And if you look at the contract under 7.9A, it says that the general partner, including the conflicts committee, shall be authorized, and authorized is not required, authorized to consider the relative interests of any party. Authorized. They can if they choose to. But then it goes on to say that nothing contained in this agreement, however, is intended to, nor shall it be construed to require the general partner, including the conflicts committee, to consider the interests of any person other than the partnership. Defined term partnership, the partnership as a whole.
What does that mean?
It means that...
In connection with a transaction of this sort. I mean, how could it mean anything other than the unit holders?
The partnership is defined as the partnership as a whole. That includes all of the partners. Their job, their task under the contract was to determine, is this trend the resolution or course of action, which is the merger, the resolution or course of action, is it fair and reasonable to the partnership, which is a defined term? And they did that.
The partnership doesn't get the proceeds of the merger. the unit holders do, and perhaps the general partner. So what is the meaning of partnership in this context? I mean, if I'm the general partner, and all I have to consider is the partnership, and the partnership basically has no financial stake in the outcome of this transaction, what's the analysis?
It means all of the partners. Is this fair and reasonable to the partnership as a whole? That's the commons, that's the preferreds, that's the generals. That's the partnership. It's all of them. But let's look at, though, what the conflicts committee actually did.
And there is some balancing, to pick a word, required.
What I would submit is, under that language, what the conflicts committee does not have to do, but which it did anyway, I should note, what they don't have to do is, what they do is they consider whether this transaction is fair to all of the partners collectively. They are authorized but not required to consider the relative interests within that. But they're not required to. It says authorized, and then it goes on to say nothing is required, nothing here shall be construed to require us to do anything other. But they went beyond that.
Well, you know, where in the contract, if partnership means all the partners, including the general partner,
that's right,
then doesn't there have to be some weighing of the relative fairness of the consideration that was to be derived by each separate party, that is the GP versus the limited partners?
I don't think that language can be reconciled with that.
Isn't partnership another undefined term, like good faith?
No, it is a defined term. It is a defined term, and it means it is defined as this partnership as a whole, not just the commons, not just the preferreds, not the generals, the partnership as a whole. It is in the definitions.
I'd like to ask a question regarding the reasonable inferences to be drawn from the complaint. The Vice Chancellor said the only reasonable inference from the allegation of the amended complaint is that KCGP relied on a qualified expert's opinion, and that invokes a conclusive presumption. But just on the previous page, the Vice Chancellor said these allegations support an inference that KCGP unreasonably exploited the LPA's limited duties to extract a personal gain that did not advance a proper partnership purpose and thus failed to act in good faith. Now, if you have different sets of inferences that can be drawn, why isn't a trial required to resolve those conflicting inferences?
Because that's what a conclusive presumption is supposed to do. It is supposed to, and I don't think those two things are at all inconsistent, because it's saying, look, absent some conclusive presumption, maybe there would have been a litigatable question on that score. But this contract that all these unit holders agreed to says that when these facts are satisfied, and they were, that a conclusive presumption arises and it becomes not litigable. That's the contract, and that's what the statute mandates be enforced.
So the other inference is irrelevant then?
Under this contract, yes. Yes, that's because otherwise, I mean, that is exactly why it's there.
All right.
Am I over my time?
You are.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Justice, may I digress on one easier issue before I address your harder ones?
In any order you wish.
Thank you. So on the issue of the vote, we had laid out in our reply brief a table which I didn't hear my colleague to challenge the accuracy of, and so I'd just like to sharpen up and reconcile his comments, Justice Jacobs, regarding how the vote played out.
What page?
Page 6 of the reply brief. KA First Reserve held about 50% of the equity, and it put in a substantial cash infusion in late 2010, so just a few months before this deal happened. And in fact, KA First Reserve played a role in brokering the transaction. Apparently, it was in on the early discussions with the counterparty, the acquirer, Kirby. So by having this transaction go through and receiving that $8.15 in merger consideration, KA First Reserve, a private equity firm, achieved about an 80% annualized return. And so certainly from its perspective, this was a wonderful deal that allowed it to exit quickly and deliver a great return to its investors. That's not the same as the long-term interests of the balance of the public unit holders of KC.
Maybe not, but it's not the same as being controlled or affiliated with the general partner either. I mean, this buyout firm was acting independently, correct?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
And private interest was.
Absolutely, and I don't mean to suggest that there's an equivalence. But if the question is ultimately fairness, because I don't read any provision in the limited partnership agreement as saying that the vote is determinative. This is not a situation like Chancellor Chandler faced in Sonnet, where the general partner held a tiny percentage of the voting equity and therefore really from the inception of the partnership didn't have the opportunity to control a vote, which the chancellor there determined was a guide to the interpretation of the LPA. Here, at the time of the IPO, KCGP and its affiliates, in fact, held a majority of the equity and absolutely could have controlled the vote at that time. 56, as I recall, Your Honor. 56%, as I recall.
So we have two divergent arguments about a verifiable fact.
Well, so only because I haven't done a good job of clarifying. The short answer, and I don't believe that this is contested, is that if you look at the public unit holders that comprise the class, that is public unit holders of KC who were not affiliates of either KA First Reserve or the general partner, then the vote of the unit holders in favor was 43%. And you only get the overwhelming vote in favor that my colleague referred to if you count the KA First Reserve votes as well.
And the KA vote was how much? What percentage?
They held just about half of the vote. That is their equity ownership.
Well, you said KCGP. Which is the general partner, had 56%.
If I said that, I misspoke. KA First Reserve, which was the private equity investor not affiliated with the GP, was the entity that held 50%. The general partner, as I recall, the general partner, together with other insiders who individually held interests, the total stake was about 14%.
And we should be concerned about the holdings of KA First Reserve. Why? Because they bought in recently and therefore they were making a killing on this?
Your Honor, I wouldn't advocate that that we worry too much about KA First Reserve. I would only make the point that they bought in recently and made a killing on their investment if the view was that their vote in favor somehow cleansed or validated the transaction.
Is it correct that the other unit holders, including the folks you represent, received a 15% premium to market?
I believe it was a higher premium than that, Your Honor.
What was it?
I believe it was a 26% premium.
Thank you very much.
I take that as be done.
Out of time.
Okay.
My colleagues don't want to hear the answer to my question, I think, at this point. Thank you, counsel, for an excellent argument. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.